Good evening, everyone. It's really nice to be together and to see all your faces on screen again. Roshi spoke 2 weeks ago, and also last week she mentioned several things that I got stuck in my mind during the day of practice. She mentioned a series of questions: what is mind? What is Sunday? And then I think it was last week where she mentioned the exchange she had with, or 2 weeks ago, when that she had with Frank, when she texted him questions. And since then, it stayed with me, and that word question. I'd like to pull the thread and see where it leads. And it, as I sat just before, I realized that today is April 1st, which is a day where in France, usually we make, I think it's like that everywhere in the world, where we make tricks and we play with people and we don't know if it's true or false. And so we really put people in a situation where suddenly a doubt arises, a question arises. So I thought, oh yeah, that's funny. It fits perfectly with April 1st, that word of question and doubt. And as I sat with that word, I also realized that what came up for me was one of the things that really draw me to Buddhism and to Zen. The fact that with my encounters with teachers, it was never about doctrines, about ideas, about things to believe in. And when I go back to memories of my first meetings with Zen teachers, Genpo Roshi, in the early 1990s, I remember him just listening, really just listening. Which was not my experience when I went to see rabbis, because my background is Jewish. It wasn't about things to believe in. So that space being created by the question was something that really captivated me, that really drew me to the practice itself. And it's very, in Zen especially, that notion of the question and the other aspect of another word, the doubt, is very, very central to the history of Zen. A term that is coined very often. There's this, I stumbled into Boshan, who is a famous 17th century monk, and he wrote a text called Exhortations for Those Unable to Arouse the Doubt. And he says, in Zen practice, the essential point is to arouse doubt. What is doubt? For example, when you're born, where do you come from? You cannot help but remain in doubt about this. When you doubt, where do you go? Again, you cannot help but remain in doubt. Since you cannot pierce this barrier of life and death, suddenly the doubt will coalesce right before your eyes. Try to put it down, you cannot. Try to put it away, you cannot. Eventually, this doubt block will be broken through and you'll realize what a worthless notion is life and death. Ah, as the old worthies said, great doubt, great awakening, small doubt, small awakening, no doubt, no awakening. So we've all heard that last line. So it's very, so it really puts the question, the doubt as a core. And I would have to say, each time we look at these things, I feel there's so many different angles looking at the practice. And this is just one entry door, I would say, or one word that where we can pull the things and see how rich it is. And so he's really putting the questions that Bhoshan mentions, where do you come from? When you die, where do you go? These are questions that usually religions have answers to. And again, I think this is one of the, for me, that was one of the appeal of this practice and of Buddhism in general, was that even though later on it developed into some kind of doctrines about all these questions, the Buddha himself never answers these questions. So the questions are being asked, and yet they're not being answered. There is a rather famous story that goes on in the early texts that you find in the middle length discourses, Majjhima Nikaya. It's the shorter discourse to Malunkyaputta, and he's this monk who is in meditation and he starts to realize that the Buddha hasn't answered these questions about whether the world is eternal or not, whether the world is finite or not, whether the soul is one thing and the body is another. I mean, all these metaphysical questions that are the backbones of any spiritual traditions, really. And he kind of realizes that he cannot continue if his teacher doesn't really answer these questions. So he goes to see him and the Buddha doesn't want to answer these questions. And this is when he brings up this famous story where he says it's like someone who has been shot by an arrow and who before accepting to be healed, he wants to know who did it and why and all these questions. Well, if you ponder on these questions, you just die. And so if you keep pondering on these questions, looking for answers, you die. You're gonna die. we're singing every day now, we're reciting the evening gatha. Well, the second line, we say, let me respectfully remind you, life and death are of supreme importance. So we tackle that matter of life and death, and yet we don't give a specific answer. Where do we go after we die? What happens? We dwell. I like that word, we dwell. We dwell in questioning. We remain in questioning. We abide in questioning. And it's not something, it's different from skepticism. It's not like, yeah, could be this and could be that. It's not also, oh, yeah, I have that. I hear what you say, you know, I have a doubt about it. It's way more profound. How to open up to the question, how to open up to life and death itself, how to open up to our experiences as a whole, without engaging in a process that will lead to definite answers. And the text that came to mind while pondering on this is this the third patriarch, Kanchi Sozan. So after Bodhidharma, you had someone, first patriarch, and so the third one, Kanchi Sozan, he wrote a poem. Well, we're not really sure if it's him, but it's usually attributed to him, even though there are doubts whether or not it's him. There's this famous line about the supreme way is not difficult if only you do not pick and choose. Neither love nor hate, and you will clearly understand. Be off by hair, and you are as far from it as heaven from earth. So how does that link with doubt? We had a discussion one morning about the verse of the Kesa, I think. Yeah, I think it was verse of the Kesa. Someone asked, so how do we practice with that? I keep going back to that question because we have all these all these words that may trigger, invite us to do things, but how do we actually work with that? What do we do with that? Okay, great doubt. Okay, great doubt. Great awakening. Okay, what do I do with that? Yeah. So, Sozan is giving us his guidance. The supreme way is not difficult if only you do not pick and choose. But Boshan, in his text, he has like several items that he sees as obstructing that possibility of doubt. The first one, I think it's like, yeah, your thought process, your intellectual thinking. But it echoes in Sozan's word, the supreme way is not difficult if only you do not pick and choose, is really the when we are engaged in our sitting, not to grasp on anything specific. Letting things appear. And I feel with the doubt, there's this, make that engagement with our experience, we make it alive. We because we're not picking and choosing. Be off by a hair, and you are as far from it as heaven from earth. I feel there is a an aesthetic experience in the doubt. Aesthetic in the sense that it involves your whole body, your whole sensation. And also it opens up to, it gives us the possibility to experience reality differently. And I like Roshi's question about what is spring. And when we did the day of practice, I was in the country and surrounded by trees, pine trees, and a lot of pine trees where I am. And they don't lose their pines during the whole year. And however, there are some other flower trees in the garden. So things are moving all the time. It's always different. It's always luxuriant. And asking these questions, it's only like, can I see it with without getting stuck on anything. I've read an article this morning that was in Le Monde, and it was about a new translation from the Bible, the I think 12 or 13 first chapters from the Genesis, by Marc-Alain Watmin, who is a rabbi and philosopher, professor, and I've followed years ago. I followed some of his classes. And he was explaining why he was very important. It was very interesting to translate again the Genesis. And anyway, at some point in the article, he mentions, and the book is illustrated with some pictures, and they chose abstract paintings. So there was a question about why did he choose abstract paintings? And he quoted Kandinsky, and that Kandinsky said, the style, figurative style, the abstraction is not the opposite as the figurative style. The subject of abstraction is time. And so he says, well, you know, you can go to a museum and see an abstract painting and just go, well, yeah, okay, whatever. Yeah, good. And you move on. Or you can sit there and see what happens. And he was taking the example of Soulage, who does only use black as a color. And we even talked about l'outre noir. That was the term coined for Soulage paintings. So if you stay long enough, you start to see things. You start to see the light. You start to see the different shadows on the painting. And so that requires time. That requires to look without any preconceived ideas. And I really like that. I looked on the in French we have from the term abstraction we have the verb abstraire, and I looked at the I was wondering what was the origin of the etymology of the term, and it comes from Latin abstraere, and it means to pull, to tear out, to pull off. So there is something in the doubt that really pulls the rug under our feet. We're asking the question, we don't know anymore, and we open up a space. So it pulls us out of our habits, of our patterns. So Koan practice does that. I can't remember where it's from, but like there's this thing with, I think when we practice Mu, we say, you know, you need to swallow the koan as a fireball or something. So it gets into you, the question really, goes into your whole body. When I was sitting with this question of this, the term question or the term doubt, I the expression, the power, the power, the power of the doubt, or the power of the question, came to my mind. Like that expression, the power of the question and the power of the doubt, and it reminded me of this other famous book which I've never read, from Eckhart Tolle, The Power of Now. So of course it's related, because it's all about the being in the moment, being present, opening up to the question. It's just another angle too. But obviously this is where that questioning leads us. So I was today thinking about this. I was like, oh, is that really the title, The Power of Now, or is there some other thing? So I googled that term, and I ended up on a website, people commenting that book. I started to look at the comments about that book, and there was one person who commented the book and said, oh yeah, actually someone lent the book to me and I gave it back because I just couldn't really finish it. And he says, not that it wasn't interesting, but really I didn't have time. And he said, well, but it's good, huh? If he says, well, I wrote it down because it was so funny. He says, well, it's a book I recommend for people who look for peace and serenity. But that person didn't have time. So this is why we, going back to our evening gatha, time swiftly passes by. An opportunity is lost. You cannot just put the book away. I was like, yeah, I'll come back later, but to it. I mean, we can. But the strange thing is that person said, if anyone wants to find peace, that person apparently still wants to be confused and want to keep on going in this life where that person has a million things to do, which is our situation of us all. So yeah, how do we cultivate doubt? How does that manifest? And I, going back to where I started, I'm still very thrilled because it can never be a dead question. Or it can never arrive to a conclusion where that is not alive, because there is an answer that would be given to it. I always find funny that we in our lineage we have all these collections of koans, and we go from one koan to the next, and as if, which even though it's not the case, but as if there is some kind of, we're going somewhere, we're passing one koan after the next. And I like the fact that in some traditions they just, you just practice with one single question all your life. Just who am I, or what is it, or what is mind? And it's sufficient. It can be sufficient for our whole life. I do appreciate that we have all these koans that also allow us to look at it from different angles, from using different terms and forcing us, even forcing us always to be creative in our answers, in our way to manifest that moment. I really appreciate that. I find that very useful. And for those who don't work on koans, hey Dell. And for those who don't work on koans, that doubt, that questioning can take place at every single moment. What is it? What is happening? And how do I, maintain this this instruction from Sozen? Not pick, not choose. And another seemingly complicated question is, well, if we do not pick and choose, how do I go on with my life? How does it work with a life of where I'm fully engaged in some in politics, in choices about environmental issues? How does that fit together? How can I maintain great doubt in our daily life, where it's sometimes we do take stance and we do take actions, and we always do action, we always take actions and we always take stance. So how does that work? And as this theme of the talk was questions and doubts, I will leave these questions open and to discussion or to comments. I'll pass the ball to you. Thank you. Any comments, thoughts, doubts? Yeah, Christine?
You said something like that there are all these questions, but there is no answer, or there's no answer given, or something like that. And there is a little voice in my mind that would like to know what's the point then? Why ask if I can't have an answer? Can you talk a little bit about?
Well, I would reverse the experiment. How is life when we are stuck with all the things, with our set of beliefs, preferences? How does life look like? And I think we can all recognize that.
Yeah, we can all relate to that.
How is it when I'm opinionated and I have my ideas about how to do things, And I really dislike people who are this way. And I think Debbie could talk for hours about that. About her experiences, about, you know, I mean, we can all do that. We know how it is. I'm saying Debbie because she did talk a lot about that many times. And she also, I think, she experienced also how that can shift. And I think that what happens is that we let go of certain ideas. We let go of, in a different language, we let go of reactivity. But that can only happen if we give ourselves some space. Actually, there is one translation that someone, I forgot who, I think it's John Peacock, I forgot who he was, but doesn't matter. There was someone who suggested to translate what we usually translate as emptiness, shunyata, as spaciousness. And it does make sense. Like, we have a sense of suddenly when we see that things are not fixed, which is the idea behind emptiness, things don't have a fixed identity, it gives us a little bit of space. But that can only happen if we let go of certain things and we dwell into non-reactivity.
Thank you. So,
there's a shift in our experience, I find. I mean, that's my experience. There's a shift in our experience when we let go, and suddenly it feels, I don't know, it feels as if the world suddenly is perceived, feels much richer, we're able to, if we let go of ideas about, for example, in a relationship, what the person should do or be and all that, suddenly we can experience that person in a different way, being touched by that person, or having a real encounter with that person, if we let go of our preferences, if we dwell in the not picking and not choosing. I always have a tendency to frame that in terms of it changes the experience that we have of things. There's a change of focus, a change of perspective, and an element of aesthetic in there. I mean, a sense of beauty that I can experiment when. Yeah, Sue?
Yeah, for me, it's the beautiful of that, of being with you all. It's do not have answer, and to have several answers, and to have always movement, always this thinking that make us thinking again, you know? If I came here to have a meeting with Hoshi, and I ask something and she gives me an answer, perhaps I don't stay here longer, you know? It's something that bring me together with you all. It's this movement. it's this abstraction. It's this no answer, no having answer. Okay, it's my...
Thank you.
Yeah. I don't know if my idea come to you.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. And I can totally relate. This is what I said. This was also my experience, and I was so moved when I read this sutra where it says basically, you know, do not follow it because someone said, you know, because there is a master, because the master is famous, or because it's the tradition. It's like, does it speak to you? Does it echo? Does it make sense? Does it make us grow? And that's only really what attracted me to that practice. Yeah, Debbie?
Yeah, this reminds me very much, now I don't know which book it was, but I read in Karen Armstrong, who was a nun, Catholic nun, and then she left, and she's written some super books about, one about Islam, and it was so intensely detailed that I finally gave up. It was, she really knows the history of Islam, and other books, and one of them, she said, grosso modo, okay, I read this quite a ways back, but it reminded me of what you were saying in the beginning, that Christianity and Judaism are spend a lot of time studying the nature of God. And Buddhism and Islam propose practices where you discover the nature of God, something like that. And it really struck me that that's the way I feel about it too. So here's one way, we can tell you the answers, but here's the other way, is you figure it out on your own. And the minute you think you figured it out, that's not the way.
Yeah, and I would argue that also in every religious traditions, these two currents are actually present. And I find that in Buddhism, Buddhism also turned into a traditional, if you look at it in terms of institutionalized tradition, where it ends up with a set of beliefs. And I was extremely shocked, because that wasn't my experience, when my mother passed away and I was at the hospital sitting next to her body, and there's this nun, very famous monk, that came and started to give me, started to tell me what's going to happen with her soul, with a bardo, and in X days, this is what will happen, and the orthodox, you know, thing. And it didn't make sense to me, and I didn't want to go into an argument of how do you know, but we also have that tendency that runs into the traditional institutionalized Buddhism, you know? But so it's very rejuvenating to hear, to read and listen, and these texts where the questioning is really put back at the center of it all.
And the other thing that came to mind was, I lived in Western Massachusetts in the 70s, which was the international center of hippiedom. And everywhere there were slogans. And one of the slogans that you found everywhere was, the answer is the question is the answer. Which at the time I thought was very hokey, but as a matter of fact,
I remember Roshi having said something like, the questions are way more interesting than any answer I could give, or something like that. Maybe that's a little bit similar.
Yeah, and suddenly, you know, when I was thinking about this question and this line from the Evening Gata, life and death are supreme importance, I was thinking how interesting that it says that, but at the same time, it is an open question. It's an invitation to really just wake up and not giving a metaphysical content about what life and death is, and this is not present. And actually, in the Zen tradition, the great matter of birth and death is synonymous for the great doubt. And I think to go back to the question, how do we work with that? Seeing it as a koan and just absorb that as a question, life and death of supreme importance. What's my life? And not closing that question with a definite answer. And it's funny because reminds me of this thing that I had done years ago. It was called the Intensive Enlightenment. It was something that some guy invented. It was more or less based on koan practices, though. It was on the question of who am I. So same thing, you know, as questions we ask in the koan practice. And if you dig that long enough and you keep asking the questions and open yourself up to all the answers, the possible answers that may come up, and you exhaust all the definitions that you have about yourself, once you've reached that point. And it's a little bit like Mu, what you will end up with is certainly not a closed definition. It's the opposite of that. And sometimes you have to express it. If you want to express it, you express it in a way that, how can we express something that would manifest that the answer to that question without enclosing it into one specific item? That's the trick, and that's the koan practice. And so it changes all the time, and different answers for the same koan. Yet, same answers. This is where sometimes Zen is very, looks like something very mysterious and obscure and nonsensical, because we reach these boundaries of meaning. Enclosed meaning. Yeah, did he?
I don't know if everybody knows light bulb jokes. Do you know light bulb jokes? I mean, do they have these in Portugal? How many feminists does it take to change a light bulb? Just one, okay? How many Zen students does it take to change a light bulb? Fish. Jaggers is not two. That's a better answer.
Well, actually, it's funny that you bring that, Debbie, because I find that, I really do find that humor is an excellent strategy to pull the rug under our feet, and you know, opening up to it. And the some of the Coens are actually really, really funny. The interactions are really funny.
Can I speak?
Yeah.
Yeah. You talk about question and answer. I get the feeling that it's more important the questioning than anything else. Just the act of making a of asking, of questioning, maybe.
Instead of what, or as opposed to what?
Not as opposed, but more than the question itself. Just keep questioning, keep
I do find that it's an interesting question, because I always wonder how specific we need to be in our practice.
Sometimes we think also, what is my question? What is my question? Who am I? Whatever. It can be anything.
Yeah, it can be anything. And I also,
it's just asking.
It can be anything, but I also do find the value of being specific to the moment also, you know. And in the practice, it's really an open question for me, because I do find that there is a value in, for example, in a meditation, just, okay, now I'm going to pay attention to sensations or emotions or in a specific situation, bring a topic in front of you, so that it makes it a little bit more focused and alive and maybe beneficial at some point, so that we stay engaged. Maybe in a situation, for example, when I would have problem with someone that really preoccupies my daily life. Instead of just sitting and it's like, yeah, whatever comes up, that comes up. But it's like, okay, what is it? What is it what comes up when I think about that person? What makes it so unbearable? Where is my clinging? because this is, there is also, for me, there is always a danger of, I find that, actually, this is one of the things that Beauchamp mentions, also the possibility of not really be fully engaged in a practice, in the practice of meditation, by not being, maybe for me, not being specific enough, you know, so that everything is kind of, yeah, whatever happens. But like, I feel maybe that by, but I don't know, it's just my take on this right now, that the questioning is more alive and engaged if, when the question is a little bit more precise, I find. But I don't have any definite answers for that. Yeah, Dan?
I just like to say in response to that, to Tiago and your, for me, it's often, that's often where I get stuck, is I'm looking for the right answer. I mean, for the right question. And so, like everything, I guess, in Zen, we have to always stay open to another view or another way of looking. That, yeah, I don't know if I was clear.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like you I don't feel like you it depends what happens in your life, you know. It's like at that precise moment, for me, the awareness about what's going on with my body is a good starting point. You interact with someone and suddenly you realize that there's a physical sensation that is happening in the body, and that at that moment I can stop and it's like, what is going on, what's happening? And then there's another situation that will arise, and it's not like we go on with our life every single moment. It's like, what's my question now? You know, but it's more like this opening up, and then at some point, the formulating a question might help. You know? And I find that for me, that goes back to what we sing, the vow of reality is boundless, our vow to see it. How do I engage moment after moment with what's happening around me, with me, around me, you know? All these various situations are possibilities to open up to, or to be closed also, and to get stuck. And then also the possibility to see that I'm stuck. I'm very often stuck, by the way.
Join the club.
All right, we're running out of time. Thank you so much for sharing. And we'll finish with the vows.